Hi, Annie Corrigan here with you. Earth Eats, bringing us all together weekly to celebrate sustainable food. A quick pledge of $5 or $10 per month to Earth Eats may not seem like a lot in your budget, but it means the world to ours. I ask you to take 2 minutes now to visit eartheats.org, click on the red Give Now button in the upper right, support WFIU Public Radio, and thank you truly. Now to the show.
Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
We worked pretty hard at it for about 2.5 months, I would say. We started in January. By the time of the fire, I was really happy with the croissants.
Eric Shedler of Muddy Fork Bakery tells us how a fire that destroyed his bakery actually ended up helping improve his brand new croissant recipe. Before that, more from my conversation with Vivian Halloran at the Lilly Library. We look at the gender differences in books about food. Two stories from Harvest Public Media about how immigrants in the Midwest are reshaping farming. And then with Chef Daniel Orr, sun-pickled radishes are great and eaten on their own, or as part of our salmon mousseline dish. Let's get informed with Luann Johnson and our food headlines.
Country of origin labeling, or COOL. It requires meat sold in U.S. grocery stores to indicate the country where the animal was born, raised, and slaughtered. The rules were put in place in 2013, but just this week, the World Trade Organization said COOL puts imported meat at a disadvantage. Food Safety News reports that the Canadian cattle and hog industries have lost a combined $900 million because of COOL. American meat farmers are also not fond of the rules, including the National Cattlemen's Beef Association and the American Meat Institute. Proponents of COOL say consumers have the right to know where their food comes from. North American meat producers say the rules are burdensome. The fate of COOL seems to lie in the hands of the WTO. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack has said the WTO will have the final say on country of origin labeling. Whole Foods unveiled its first-ever nationwide marketing campaign on the heels of its sustainability ratings announcement last week. In an attempt to shake off negative perceptions, like the nickname Whole Paycheck, that has plagued the retailer for its higher prices, Whole Foods is attempting to establish itself as the brand of choice for organics. Whole Foods is focusing on values with its new campaign, showing farms where the company sources its meat and produce alongside the farmers who tend them. The campaign includes full-page glossy print ads and commercials that run in primetime television spots, costing around $15 to $20 million. Whole Foods must now compete with retailers like Walmart and Kroger, which have launched their own organic lines of produce. And ghouls and goblins aren't the only thing frightening children this Halloween. Typical Halloween candy is filled with some of the most common food allergens: peanuts, tree nuts, eggs, wheat, soy, and dairy. With food allergies on the rise over the past decade, trick-or-treating has become a health risk for some. Enter the Teal Pumpkin Project. Sponsored by the group Food Allergy Research and Education, the Teal Pumpkin Project is an easy way to let children with allergies safely participate in trick-or-treating. In addition to, or instead of, offering candy, the Teal Pumpkin Project encourages the giving of non-food items like toys, stickers, bubbles, or crayons. Simply paint a pumpkin the color teal, the official color of food allergy awareness, and place it where you'll be giving out treats. This way, children and their caregivers will know you're offering non-food treats. Are you navigating Halloween treats while avoiding allergies? Send us a note with your suggestions and comments. Our email is eartheats@gmail.com. And be sure to visit eartheats.org to find links to Halloween-related organizations.
Thanks for the news, Luann.
Happy to do it.
Immigration is helping to reshape what agriculture looks like in the Midwest. Farming is already more ethnically diverse than it was even a decade ago. In the first of a two-part series on immigration's impact on agriculture, Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer introduces two young immigrants just starting out.
Bear Creek Dairy in Brooklyn, Iowa is home to more than 1,100 cows who produce about 100,000 pounds of milk each day. That many cows means lots of calves. Toon Boulin works closely with the calves.
Well, actually, that one might be 5 weeks, this one might be 3 weeks.
These animals are the next generation of milk cows here, and 15-year-old Bulan is in the next generation of farmers. He comes from a long line of dairymen in Europe. 5 years ago, his parents sold their farm in the Netherlands and bought this one in Iowa. Doreen Bulan, Toon's mother, says their farm couldn't grow where they were.
We could sell our land to the city, and because there were no possibilities for us to stay there longer than 20 years, we calculated, and to give them a farming future.
They had money to invest, and that led to green cards. Now, Toon and one of his brothers hope eventually to farm full-time alongside their parents. Their immigrant experience is unique. The majority of immigrants arriving in the Midwest today come from Latin America, and most work whatever jobs they can. Their kids often turn away from agriculture.
I was born in Congo. My parents are from Burundi.
Pacific Simon and his family represent yet another path. After fleeing war and living years in refugee camps, 6 years ago, the family received asylum in the United States. They landed in Des Moines with plenty of life experience and not a lot of cash. Back in Burundi, the family farmed. Now, thanks to a partnership between Lutheran Services in Iowa and Valley Free Church in West Des Moines, they once again can get their hands in the dirt. They're even selling some vegetables at a farmer's market alongside other refugee vendors.
Yeah, we are so happy about it because we got to... We produce a lot of stuff this year, and then we are making like good money too. Yeah, that's a good thing to get like a little bit another income.
Simon, who's 22, enjoys helping in the field, but he can see that his family's donated plot will never support him. He's majoring in agricultural systems technology at Iowa State University. He says classmates from farm families have an easier time becoming farmers. But he's set his sights on an ag career that includes Africa.
I want to learn some skill here and then go teach people back there so they can produce enough food to feed their own family.
Toon Bulan and his family hearken to a past era of Europeans as the dominant newcomers to this region. Pacific Simon and other African, Asian, and especially Latin American immigrants will contribute more to the future of farming in the heartland. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
Another story from Amy Mayer in the second half of the show about how Latino children may be poised to be the next generation of leaders in Midwest farming. We're back at the Lilly Library with Vivian Halloran, Associate Professor of American Studies and English at Indiana University. Last week, we talked about influential American food books from the early 20th century. Today, as we look around her exhibition, Book Bites, she highlights the differences between how men and women write about their food experiences. Can you tell a difference between the cookbooks written by men, cookbooks written by women? Is there some sort of gendered aspect to these books?
Yes and no. I mean, James Beard is an interesting case because he actually, it's called the Fireside Cookbook, as if you're going to read it by the fire, but he actually includes recipes for grilling outdoors, and the women don't. And so, by and large, that's the extent of the culinary gender difference that I could discern. At this point, we see more of a pronounced difference later because women don't publish memoirs of things they ate.
More on that in a minute. The Fireside Cookbook was first published in 1949. You likely know James Beard not as an author or an educator, but as the namesake for the annual Culinary Awards. In the 1950s, an influential columnist was furthering the careers of female cooks.
These are cookbooks on ethnic cuisine, but they're all prefaced or somehow endorsed by Craig Claiborne, who was, of course, from Mississippi and the longtime New York Times food critic. So his stamp of approval, I'm calling him one of the influential tastemakers, his review of Mastering the Art of French Cooking made it possible for Julia Child to have the credibility that she then actually earned on her own after that. He, in a sense, vetted and made it possible for Gracia Chu, Edna Lewis, for Diana Kennedy, and for Marcella Hassan, who died recently, for them to set up cooking schools in their own homes. So in the old school tradition of having your own cooking school, and then you published a cookbook, even Julia Child, they all saw themselves as educators, primarily. and they were able to support themselves and make a real name as being authorities of these cuisines, in no small part due to the endorsement they received from Claiborne.
Moving into the 1990s, she includes Jeffrey Steingarten's book, The Man Who Ate Everything, and books by Calvin Trillin that rejoice in the pleasures of eating. Which brings us back to our question from earlier. Why do women not write these books about the experience of eating?
I think it's a fascinating thing. I think it has to do with women's internalized sense that speaking about eating and enjoying eating is too fraught. That if you're talking about eating, the immediate question from the reader will be, well, did you gain weight? Women, when they write about food, like MFK Fisher does, she's an unapologetic aficionado of the oyster, but she nonetheless includes recipes. She thinks other people want to do things with it, and the men are content to talk about being hungry for good food, finding good food that's appealing, and enjoying the feeling of being full and having eaten a good meal. And somehow in itself, that narrative arc of I'm hungry, I found food, I am now stuffed and happy, is gendered as male. And something I hope to combat by saying it's a freedom men enjoy that women should claim as well.
Vivian Halloran organized the exhibition at the Lilly Library called Book Bites, Texts That Influenced and Reflected How America Eats. More about this at eartheats.org. Coming up...
Now, it looks like a, you know, kind of very unassuming mayonnaise-type sauce, but I think when you taste it, you're really going to enjoy it.
Not that there's anything wrong with mayonnaise. Chef Daniel Orr is making salmon in sauce form. So good. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, now with 5 locations in Bloomington. Blooming Foods has supported locally produced food and artisanal goods since 1976. BloomingFoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness Massage and Yoga, 812-337-3529 or 33RELAX. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Hey, hope you're enjoying today's show. Consider tossing a couple bucks into the Earth Eats Kitty to give us a leg up in this year's fundraising efforts. We are able to do what we do because our listeners do their part. WFIU.org/support, and thanks.
Okay, you ready?
Annie Corrigan here with Chef Daniel Orr. It's Earth Eats.
I'm going to show you a recipe that my friend Mihoko taught me how to make when I was living in New York City and had a rooftop penthouse garden. So this is a sun-pickled radish. She did it with the daikon radish. Daikon is this big radish you can see here. It's almost like a baby's arm.
A muscular baby at that.
A little Arnold Schwarzenegger baby. All right. So you can use that, and that's what I traditionally use. But this year at Kolb Homestead, our farm, we're getting all these little long radishes. These are 2.5 to 3 inches long, red, really, really pretty. What you do is you take your radishes, and I put them in a plastic container. Okay, now we're going to put quite a bit of salt, okay? And we're just going to rub that salt into the radishes. This is going to help the salt permeate the radish and start drawing out the liquid. And then you're going to go put this in the sunniest part of your yard. Or if you live on a rooftop like I used to, put it on the rooftop. Now, things happen outside that don't happen inside, like bird flyovers and things like that. So what I always do is put a piece of cheesecloth on top so nothing can go in there. And you leave them out there for about 10 days to 2 weeks. And what you get is I've got some that we did. And you can see how they've shriveled up, dried up. Then what you do is you finish it. Some rice wine vinegar. some sugar, and some ginger. If you want to make them spicy, you could put some crushed red pepper flakes on there too. And I'm going to let you try one of these little sun pickles.
Still crunchy.
These will last a long time. Now you could put them in a jar, keep them in the fridge. But I serve these chopped up fine on top of my pea soup. It'd be great to have on a sushi platter.
Daniel Orr has another suggestion for how to serve these little flavor bullets. Another recipe in about 10 minutes. For years, Latino immigrants have filled some of the least glamorous, most physically taxing jobs in farming. In the second part of our two-part series on immigration's impact on agriculture, Amy Mayer looks at a generation of Latino children who may be uniquely qualified to lead the Midwest's agricultural economy in the future.
In a dimly lit Des Moines school lab, students in an advanced agricultural sciences class wear aprons, safety goggles, and plastic gloves to poke and probe chicken wings. They're looking for ligaments, tendons, and other features of this animal part that teenagers more often experience cooked and covered in barbecue sauce.
Miss Mom thought you'd never guess what we found.
What'd you find?
The ligaments.
Good job.
Yay! High five.
A 17-year-old senior, with her hair pulled back in a ponytail for the dissection, celebrates with her lab partner. This young woman is a chapter officer in the Des Moines FFA group and recently got elected to a district-wide leadership position. She's already earned a full scholarship to Iowa State University and aspires to be a large animal veterinarian with her own small cattle herd. Her name is Melissa Garcia Rodriguez.
My mom came to the U.S. She went to California first, and she met my dad there on a strawberry field, and they shared a bean taco.
Born and raised in Des Moines, Garcia comes from a Mexican family.
They had family in Des Moines, and they heard there was good jobs there. So they came here, then I was born, and then my little brother.
Here in the heartland, as in California, many immigrants find work as dairy hands, crop pickers, or, especially, in meatpacking plants. Today, Mexico is the single largest country of birth for immigrants in the Midwest. And Iowa, for instance, now has four school districts in which more than half of the student body is Hispanic or Latino. Each of those communities is also home to a meat processing plant. Still, Garcia says she often feels isolated.
Personally, I have not met any other Latina or Latino student in the FFA, except for maybe one that I met my sophomore year.
The careers in Iowa, agriculture, agribusiness, really seemed to me to be a very excellent position for students in the future who speak English fluently, speak Spanish fluently, you know, understand the Hispanic culture, Latino culture.
That's Dale Gruce, a consultant with Iowa's education department. He says Latino students, as they come of age, could tap into the Midwest's biggest business. But Latino enrollment in agricultural science classes at high schools and community colleges is out of sync with the Latino population. Iowa State University sophomore Christina Gonzalez has an idea why.
For a person who comes from immigrant families, like they've seen their families go through maybe farming, agriculture, whatnot, and they see it as, you know, this is something that my parents did and they came here for me to do something better.
Gonzalez thought she was going to study theater in college, but her older cousin, Brian Castro, who graduated from Iowa State, drew her into the College of Agriculture. They both grew up on Chicago's South Side, their parents all immigrants from Mexico. Castro agrees that the role for bilingual, bicultural Latino Americans in agriculture goes far beyond the entry-level jobs of many new immigrants.
There's just like a huge misrepresentation of the Latino of Latino workers in the decision-making area for agriculture, even though they are like the number one, the main population of the workers.
Castro says people like him can be an important go-between for farm managers and recent immigrants. Many of agriculture's biggest players are lobbying for a permanent guest worker program because farm workers from Latin America keep the industry humming.
But with the sheep.
In the barn at the Des Moines Ag campus, Melissa Garcia Rodriguez breezes past a hog and opens the gate to a sheep pen. Soon she'll be raising her first steer. She says she's found her passion with livestock.
There's a career and a job out there waiting for me. And then hopefully one day I'll reach my goal of having my own farm.
It's a lofty dream for anyone with no family land to work. But in a way, Garcia would be carrying on both a family and an American tradition. Her grandfather raised cattle in Mexico, and her parents have worked hard in the United States so that she can do whatever she wants. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media is a reporting collaboration focusing on issues of food, fuel, and field. More stories like this one are at harvestpublicmedia.org. Bloomington's Muddy Fork Bakery is known especially for their hearth breads like their baguettes, rustic sourdough, and Jewish rye. But this year, baker Eric Shedler took up a new baking challenge, the croissant. And our Mark Chilla found out Shedler's journey of creating the perfect croissant was full of some unexpected twists and turns.
Eric Shedler of Bloomington's Muddy Fork Bakery is pounding out the dough for his croissants over the sound of some gravel being spread outside. Now, construction noises are not what you typically hear at a bakery, but this is not your typical week.
This is our first week fully using our new bakery.
And as you can hear, they're still moving in. Making croissants, as I learned, is a multi-step process spread out over the course of nearly a whole day.
Three layers of dough and two layers of butter in there.
He's showing me a very crucial first step, the initial lamination, which is just a fancy term for layering.
To about 11 by 17. And then we have the butter that I already...
Those layers include a special mix of dough and butter. Lots of butter.
So it's 1 pound, that's 1 pound of butter.
Okay, croissant making 101. The butter and dough are flattened out into thin rectangles and then folded into one another.
Over two-thirds of the dough and fold the extra flap of dough over half the butter.
Shedler repeats this folding process several times every few hours each Friday for five batches in total.
Roll it out to full size, fold it in thirds, roll it out to full size, fold it in thirds, and then roll it out to 36 inches long. And cut triangles for the croissants and roll them up.
They're shaped, baked, and voila. Croissants ready for the Saturday farmers market.
Saturday is just an exhausting day. Come in here at 3 and start baking and then hustle it out of here and go to market and then spend 5 hours at market making pizzas on site.
The croissant's journey to the market started all the way back in December of last year as a birthday request for his wife and baking partner, Katie.
And I had never made them before. I hadn't really eaten croissants much. For whatever reason, they never seemed appealing to me. And then after I made them the first time, I decided that I really liked them.
He spent weeks trying to perfect the recipe. This meant finding the right mix of sourdough to add to the dough.
That's one of the things that we worked on for a long time, is figuring out just how much starter to add to the dough so that it would be just a little bit sour, just a subtle hint of sour.
And finding the perfect kind of butter to use, which he found from the Hartzler Family Dairy, a farm in Ohio.
So a typical American butter would be about 80% fat, and this is probably 82 or 83, and just that difference makes it softer at cold temperatures.
And finally, the perfect croissant was made.
I worked pretty hard at it for about 2.5 months, I would say. We started in January, and by the time of the fire, I was really happy with the croissants.
Yes, the fire. On March 21st, the first day of spring, tragedy. Muddy Fork's bakery caught fire in the middle of the night.
It was pretty devastating, and there were definitely a lot of tears in the first week or two. My first immediate reaction was actually relief, because we had a two-week-old baby at the time. And Katie was up in the night with the baby, and then this was a terrible scream. Like, I've never heard from her, and I first thought that something happened to the baby and then ran out and saw, oh, it's just the bakery.
But all was not lost. One of Katie's cousins set up an online crowdsourced fundraising account to help Muddy Fork get back up and running. They raised $20,000 in 5 days. That, with the insurance money, allowed them to rebuild, which brings us to today. The new space is a blessing for Shedler and the bakery.
Well, it's about twice as big, and then we have a walk-in cooler where we have enough space to chill all the dough overnight so that it's possible to bake at 3 in the morning without staying up the entire night.
In addition to the new cooler, they have a new work table and a new and bigger oven with some improved features.
It's pretty much everything you could ask for if you're a baker.
The new space means that he can make more bread and more of those brand new croissants. Although at this point, maybe not too many more.
I think we at this point don't want to try to produce more than we're need for market, more up to 10 dozen.
For Earth Eats, I'm Mark Chilla.
Pictures of Muddy Fork's new bakery and their croissants are at eartheats.org. All right, time to get out your high-powered blender. Daniel Orr's Vitamix is a workhorse in his kitchen. You'll need it for this mousseline recipe. He's making a light, airy, foamy sauce with smoked salmon. Now, this is cool.
So what we're going to do is we're going to take 3/4 pounds of salmon, put that in our blender. Then we're going to add about 1.5 to 2 cups of milk. We also have 1/4 teaspoon of curry, 10 drops of hot sauce. We're going to add a little bit of salt. The salmon's already salty, so you don't want too much. And we're going to let that blend. Start it on slow. And then you're going to increase the speed. Kick it on super high. Okay, Annie, so if you look down here, you can see that it's gotten thick, a little pink from the salmon. Do you like salmon, Annie?
Oh, I love smoked salmon. I'm sort of, I'm feeling a little offended that you're sort of pureeing it into a sauce because I love it so much just on bagels with cream cheese.
Well, this is also a great way to, like, use up the little scrappy pieces. I'm going to add a little lemon juice and about 1/4 cup of heavy cream. Turn it back on low. Got some warm asparagus, and I'm going to spoon over the smoked salmon mousseline. We're going to garnish it with just a couple pink peppercorns, a little bit of chives, and some chive flowers.
Speedy.
There we go. Now, it looks like a, you know, kind of very unassuming mayonnaise-type sauce, but I think when you taste it, you're really going to enjoy it. The plate's very hot, so be careful.
Woo, that's incredible. Oh, my goodness.
And really simple.
Daniel Orr made this for us back in the spring, so that's why asparagus is the star of this recipe. But use whatever's coming out of your garden right now to make this seasonally appropriate. Check out the recipe and the photos at eartheats.org. See if you can spot the sun-pickled radishes as garnish on the plate. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, now with 5 locations in Bloomington. Blooming Foods has supported locally produced food and artisanal goods since 1976. BloomingFoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, 1 block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness Massage and Yoga, 812-337-3529 or 33RELAX. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. I'm Annie Corrigan. Thanks for joining us at the Earth Eats table today. We're saying thank you often these days. Our fund drive at WFIU is going well because our listeners are becoming members. If you haven't given a couple dollars to Earth Eats just yet, well, now would be a great time. Make a quick pledge at WFIU.org/support. It means a lot. And thanks.